And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Michael Schratt about the evidence that supports the claim that elements of the military-industrial complex, and then specifically the American aerospace industry, although, of course, this might be international as well, but that they have designed, built, and test-flown saucer-shaped aircraft, which is basically mimics the form, fit, and function of the what we know as the extraterrestrial UFOs. And one of the things, beyond talking a little bit more about Leonard Stringfield and, of course, your book, Michael, tell us a little bit more about what you, how do we interpret some of the comments that you mentioned at the last segment there, right at the end, of actually their possibility of traveling to the stars. I mean, if we think about that a little bit, it means obviously that they have a potentiality of going practically anywhere they want out there. They could go at any place. What do you think is the main motive and objective here? Many people have been talking about a Earth 2.0. They're trying to set up a new colony somewhere. They might be doing a super advanced space station or something like that, which still is outside of the reach of you know, what we can see and everything else. But is there any inclination as to what actually is the main objective or motive of why they're developing the program?
Well, what I would say to that is, again, it's not me that's stating it. It's the military officials and people who work in the programs that are making the statements. I want to put that forth right away. Let me give you one quick example. There was a Marine in 1963 who was flown from Cherry Point, North Carolina on a three-hour commercial airline flight that was completely blacked out. This is his story, not mine. And he was never told where he landed. So I don't know the location of this undisclosed hangar facility. But his job was to guard about a 30-foot diameter dish-shaped craft that kind of looked like a hamburger that had 10 elliptical-shaped black windows around the outer circumference of the vehicle. The craft was supported by aircraft scaffolding about 5 feet off the bottom hangar floor so that engineers could pass below. And then there was a catwalk that had stairways that went up on the scaffolding, and then 360 degrees around the outside circumference of the vehicle, there was catwalk so you could walk around it for engineers. And he said that there were two teams of 50 white lab coat technicians that were, like, on a daily basis trying to not only find out how this is built, but the propulsion system, but the most important thing is they were just trying to breach the hull of this vehicle. So, you know, was it one of ours? You know, would they be having difficulty breaching the hull of one of our vehicles? Were they even clued into that? But this is what he stated. He said that he was the head of security, so he checked the other people who were going into the facility. So he actually snapped a photograph of this craft sitting on the scaffolding. But in 1982, there was a flood in his area, and that photograph was lost. So we were that close to maybe getting access to a photograph of perhaps an extraterrestrial vehicle. But one point I wanted to bring out is, he said that they originally used air-powered jackhammers to breach the hull of this vehicle. That didn't work. Then they used a conventional acetylene torch to breach the hull. That didn't work. And then he said that they used a very high-powered laser. This is 63, so it would have been kind of like primitive technology for lasers at that time. Mm-hmm. But he said they used a high-powered electrical laser that had two black, thick electrical cables coming from the laser torch itself to what he said was two 18-wheel tractor trailers that were providing the power source for this laser. And he said that when they went full power on the hull of this vehicle and they moved the laser away, there was nothing there. No scorch mark, no dent, nothing, nothing. There's no evidence to indicate they ever even got inside this craft. And he said on the last day that they were there, all he saw was the craft that he had been guarding for 2 weeks loaded on an 18-wheeler tractor trailer lowboy truck, and they were securing it with chains with a tarp, and he never saw it again. It was driven off. He never saw it again. This is according to a U.S. Marine in 1963 who was allegedly there.
All right. Wow. Well, that's too bad. How much, if anything, does exist in terms of photos? I'm not talking about just kind of the craft that we do see, but is there any other really good photographs, as far as you're concerned, of any of the programs that they've had and the developments of any of these UFO-type crafts?
Well, see, that's what ufology is lacking. Since 1947, this is just, you know, my assessment here. Since 1947, how far has ufology really gotten? How much do we really know when you really come down to it? Now, yes, we've made some breakthroughs. We've made some advancements. But my point is, now that it's, you know, been well over 60 years since Roswell, what do we really know? Have we made any breakthroughs? This comes from the Leonard Springfield files, where Gordon Cooper stated that the only way that ufology will ever advance is if a group of well-known scientists overrule the military-industrial complex and the military intelligence agencies and come forward with the physical evidence themselves. That's the only way we're going to make progress, and I tend to believe with Gordon Cooper's assessment.
Yeah, well, that seems like a tough challenge, of course. Not impossible, though, but if we talk about a moment for, let's say, insiders speaking out of someone opening up the lid to this and potentially this getting way out of, you know, control for the powers that be of trying to keep the lid on this, making comparisons to something like the Manhattan Project, we can realize that, of course, there's been secrecy successful for a fairly long time, and very few people have actually been, you know, speaking out about it, if any at all. Is there any, as far as you're concerned, insiders like this that have either been speaking out or attempting to do it? I mean, because the questions are, is the non-disclosure agreement, you know, is that enough? Is it potentially the people have been silenced, maybe even murdered for the attempting of divulge some of the secrets about some of these programs? Any ideas about any of this?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I think it's such a tragedy that the Leonard Springfield files, now it's believed that there are 40 bank boxes of original material with these whistleblowers. I tried to vet out as many as I could. I did include them in the book. However, I could not use their names to protect their identity, but I do have that whistleblower testimony in the book with the illustrations, the drawings, and the 3D full-color artwork as well. So I would just say that don't believe me. You can read their assessment of it and make your own conclusion.
How much of that material, then, do you think is, what is the level of the quality of it within this material, of the Stringfield files or boxes, whatever we want to call it?
I found the quality very good. There were pathologists in there. There were medical doctors in there. There were dentists in there, engineers, pilots, test pilots, foreign personnel, intelligence community people. Let me give you one quick example. This is a pattern that I've found in at least 12 separate cases where, as most people know, all roads seem to lead back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I keep hearing the reports, and this happens over and over and over again, at least 12 separate times, where when they have they can already sense and detect what the flight path of these vehicles incoming are and where the potential crash site will be. They have a rapid response team that gets on site immediately. They cordon off the area. They secure the area. Then a low boy 18-wheeler flatbed tractor trailer is brought on site. The craft is loaded onto the trailer. It's secured by chains. It's covered with a tarp. And then it's brought back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, that only works when the discs are 30 feet in diameter and lower. If they get larger than that, in many cases, they bury the craft at the site. So this is a pattern that I've seen over and over again, and the witnesses keep on telling me within the documents that all roads lead to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
But they might have buried it at the site. That's interesting, because that might...
They buried it at the site. They're not going to risk it, because if you think about it, let's go back. Let's just say 1947 and 1953. The roads around America were a lot more primitive than they are today. This is like the beginning of the highway system and paved roads and everything. A lot of times we only had one lane dirt road, or even if it was paved, it was very narrow, and we had trees next to it, and we had telephone poles. And if there was a crash retrieval in California and you had to bring it back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and you could only travel like 19 miles an hour, and you had 1,700 miles to go, and you could only do it at night, it could take potentially months to retrieve a crash retrieval that occurred in California and get it all the way back to Dayton, Ohio. You've got to deal with security leaks. You've got eyewitnesses. You've got to unearth thousands of trees. You've got to move telephone poles. It's just not going to happen. It's physically impossible. It can't be done. And you can't use a helicopter because in 47, we didn't have totally sophisticated helicopters that could heavy lift something that was really large if it was heavy. So they, by default, their only option is to bury it at the site. Logistics alone would tell you that they just can't move it that far.
Interesting point. That could potentially mean that they still have their eye on a huge map over the U.S. of no-no zones for digging and
sure.
development then.
Sure.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, anything about the boys flying this stuff? Regular Air Force pilots, should we assume? Is this special operations and education for this kind of stuff?
Instead of giving you my opinion, let me tell you what Ben Rich said. Again, head of Lockheed Skunk Works between 75 and 1991. On July 1st of 1986, a friend of mine by the name of John Andrews, who is no longer with us, he was friends with Ben Rich. This is without any doubt true. This is known within the historical aviation community. He was very good friends with Ben Rich, and John Andrews was the senior project design engineer for Testor's Model Corporation in Rockford. He headed up their San Diego branch, and he was the one who designed the F-19 stealth fighter model that went on to become the world's most selling plastic model kit of all time. It just blew away every other kit in the world. This kit sold more models than any other kit in the world. So we'll just keep that in mind. So this is July 1st, 1986. John Andrews wrote a letter to Ben Rich asking Ben Rich if he was a believer in UFOs. Okay, so on July 8th, I have it right in front of me, Lockheed Advanced Aeronautics Company letterhead. This is Ben's reply. Ben Rich replied, July 8th, 1986. It says, "Dear John, in response to your letter of July 1st, I am a believer, and so is Kelly Johnson." Okay, so then he wrote back, "Ben, could you please clarify your statement? Are you a believer in Category A, man-made UFOs, or Category B, extraterrestrial UFOs?" So then Ben Rich wrote back again to John, and this is dated 7/21/86, and I was fortunate enough to acquire this original letter handwritten by Ben. It says, "Dear John, yes, I'm a believer in both categories. I feel everything is possible. Many of our man-made UFOs were unfunded opportunities. In both categories, there are lots of kooks and charlatans. Be cautious, Ben Rich." So here we have Ben Rich stating that not only is he a believer in man-made and extraterrestrial UFOs, but Kelly Johnson was a believer in extraterrestrial UFOs. So if it's good enough for Kelly Johnson, it's good enough for me.
Right, right, yep.
So what I'm saying is that not everything out there is man-made. I mean, if you look at it,
sure.
The historical legacy of UFO cases date prior to the Roman Empire, prior to the Egyptians. We've got reports in historical documents from Columbus. We're talking 1492 here. So this is prior to Skunk Works by hundreds, thousands of years. So we can't say that everything is man-made. In point of fact, Kelly Johnson himself had two UFO sightings that went to the National Archives and Record Administration in College Park. It's in the Blue Book files. His exact sighting is in the Blue Book files. So again, if it's good enough for Kelly Johnson, it's good enough for me, and not everything is man-made.
Tell us about some of the other cases of the kind of obscure or forgotten, neglected UFO crashes / retrieval cases that you've compiled there as well.
Okay. I want to give you a very interesting case that personally I believe is one of ours. This is reported in the April Bulletin. I'm going to discuss this in my lecture. I will like to mention that I have renamed the title of my lecture. I'm calling it now, "Inside the Black World, Exposing the Government's Silver Bullet Technology." That's going to be my title now. This is April Bulletin, February 3rd, 1983. This is a true case according to primary eyewitnesses who were driving back from a bingo game 9 o'clock at night. And this individual heard a big boom noise. Her car started vibrating. She pulled off to the side of the road, got out of the car, thinking her transmission fell out. Looked under the vehicle. It seemed fine. She got back in her car, drove another 2 minutes, and then she saw a bright white light in a clearing forest field. And then she saw, which I'm going to show illustrations of this. Everything I do is all visual. There's no reading or boring charts. It's all visual. She saw a 272-foot-long cigar-shaped craft with a ball on the front of it. It was about 70 feet tall. It had a tapering aft section of the craft. The whole thing was fastened by what she said, not me, what she said were rivets. So there's point number one, rivets. Would an extraterrestrial craft use rivets to hold itself together? I don't think so. I could be wrong, but I don't think so. She said that there on the upper level, there was a transparent section that had what looked like 5'10" humanoid-looking creatures that were wearing what she termed white one-piece tight-fitting flight suits. Below that transparent section, there was another transparent section, and then below that, there was a door that was closing from right to left, and below that door, she said she could see what looked like an asphalt road in the mid-portion of this vehicle. And then the final point I want to make is that on the left side of this door, there was a wall, and if you remember our other previous discussion on the Hudson Valley Boomerang and on the Belgium Triangle, vintage 1989-1990, these craft had tubes, pipes, and cylinders sticking on the bottom understructure of the vehicle. This lady said that on the left side of this wall, she said that she saw what looked like, quote, tubes, pipes, and cylinders sticking out of this wall. So again, this is the third time we've seen this motif again. This doesn't sound alien to me. She also stated that on the bottom surface of this vehicle, there were hundreds of these 12-inch by 12-inch square, highly reflected, polished mirror sections that were in a cross configuration, and there was a gondola hanging down from that cross with another tier of humanoid-looking creatures who were absolutely looking at her without any doubt. But she also said that there were dozens and dozens of circular transparent windows throughout this whole vehicle, and when she looked inside, she saw what looked like bulkheads from a ship that was in a dry dock. Those were her words, not mine. So again, I don't think if you take this all together that this is something extraterrestrial.
Let's talk a little bit more about some of the, I think you've talked about electrogravitics before, of basically electrically charging the wings, is it the tips of the wings, to be able to reduce fuel, etc. There's a number of things that might have been employed over the years to advance just fuel consumptions, correct?
You're absolutely right about this. Was an interesting, I think it's March 9th, 1992. I've got the article here. Talked about how disgruntled engineers at Northrop facility were very upset that classified propulsion technology was being utilized on the B-2 stealth bomber, but wasn't being trickled into the airline industry. So this is, again, the Northrop engineers who are talking about this. And one of the technologies that they said was used in this article, this is March 9th, 1992, they said that the B-2 electrically charged the leading edge of the wing to reduce the radar cross signature, but then also electrically charged the exhaust gases to reduce the infrared signature. And so what actually happens when you do that, what you do is you set up a gravity wave where there's a gravity hill in back of the aircraft and a gravity well in front of the aircraft. So in point of fact, the aircraft is kind of riding on this surfer's wave, and you could almost shut down the engines and it'll propagate itself. That's the level of technology that may be employed on the B-2 stealth bomber. We've never been able to 100% conclusively prove that, but this is coming from the Lockheed, from the Northrop engineers. And so what they were saying is, and the reason why they were upset about it is, why would the airlines charge you, you know, $1,000 for a round-trip ticket when they could charge you like $5 is what they should be charging you? So in point of fact, they're going to lose money if this black world technology gets incorporated into the airlines. So if you could retrofit this technology and put it on a 727 or a 747, There'd be no need to charge these outlandish airfares. They could be doing it for $10, but we're never going to see this technology because there's just so much black world funding into this, and it would doom the airline industries. They'd be out of business if it were done. So we're never going to see it. So in point of fact, they're right.
Right. Well, they could scrap that green tax they put on the air flight tickets as well. I don't know what it is, around 10% or something ridiculous like that. You know,
It's just incredible. Yeah. And when you do this too, you have the potential of exceeding the speed of sound without creating a sonic boom because you're essentially massaging the air molecules ahead of the aircraft. And so that may be one reason when you hear these reports of these black aircraft and UFOs departing like a spark off a grinding wheel, that there's no sonic boom because they've already figured out that technology. They've already eliminated the sonic boom footprint decades ago. And here we are in 2014, we're living in this obsolete world with these obsolete airliners chugging away at 500 miles an hour when they can be going supersonic and it can be retrofitted on a conventional airliner.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Now, is it just, are many of these things just too complicated for other people to develop or come up with the concepts to? I mean, I know that there's a lot of people out there making claims and such, but I guess at the end of the day, so far today, we don't have anything, no matter what people claim that they have in their garage or whatnot. Is this something that's kind of constricted within the realm of the something like the a defense budget because it's just so costly to develop some of this stuff?
Well, all I would say is the B-field Brown effect was researched in the 50s and 60s, and T. Townsend Brown had perfected his patent number 3,187,206. So he was smart enough to figure it out back in 1965. I can't imagine the engineers who are working at Lockheed, working at Northrop and Boeing, they were also able to figure it out as well. So I can't say it must have been that difficult. So it can't be all that impossible to retrofit it on a 777.
Right, yeah. How about the gravity question in terms of some of the extraordinary maneuverability that we see in some of these crafts? Is there a method of canceling that out?
Interesting you mentioned that. I would highlight some of the things that were stated by Edgar Fouché. When he came out and disclosed this information, I believe it was 1998, at the International UFO Congress, essentially, he was crucified. I have to give him credit. He was crucified for coming forth with a number of the information that he did. I think he should deserve more credit than he did because he was the first one to come forth with this information. He talked about a triangular craft that he said that he saw a prototype of this vehicle. This is the black triangles that have been seen all around the world since 1975. They actually predate 1975. Basically, he stated that they come in two sizes, between 300 and 600 feet per side on the triangle, so they're very, very black. This is the TR-3B. It's been stated that the TR-3B stands for Tactical Reconnaissance. In point of fact, that's incorrect according to Edgar Fouché. It actually stands for Teledyne Ryan. That's what that stands for the primary contractor. Now, I don't know who is the prime contractor for the propulsion system, but it appears that Teledyne Ryan has a whole series of these black triangles that they've been building perhaps since the early mid-1970s. In a nutshell, according to Fouché, there's a magnetic field disruptor on the interior central portion of this triangle, and it's pressurized to 250,000 atmospheres at 50,000 RPM. There's a liquid mercury plasma based within this, and there's a resulting gravity distortion up to 89%, meaning that the multi-mode impulse rockets at each point of the triangle only have to propel 11% of the craft. And the pilots in this vehicle only experience 11% of the G-forces as well. So that's how they can make these leaps, these stops on the dimes, these 90-degree right angle turns on a dime on a split second. According to Edgar Fouché, they've already got the technology.
Let me ask you a little bit more, or let's talk a little bit more about the group, I guess. It's obviously very possible that when they indeed started up this particular project in the United States, they piggybacked on the prior industrial and ingenuity success of the National Socialists, the rocket scientists, the others, you know, engineers and mechanics there in Deutschland, of course. But it's obvious that at some point here that it was after Project Paperclip, it was run by a different guard, in my opinion, anyway. And the fact is that this was absorbed into the program and they managed to do some extraordinary stuff. And you mentioned a couple of people there before. Of course, there were kind of the triangle of those people who have an idea about things, including William Perry and, of course, George W. Bush, or Herbert Walker Bush, I guess. What can you say about the group overall, this, the rogue group that are pulling the strings within this? Is there anything more we know about them?
What I would say to that is, you know, everybody thinks that it's the U.S. Air Force that's keeping the secrets. They have the cover-up, they're running the show, and the high-level Air Force, I'm not so sure. Keep in mind that over 50% of UFO sightings are, in point of fact, USO sightings, unidentified submerged objects. You know, and the argument is Edgar Fouché is wrong and he's lying, and there's no way that the government could hide a 600-foot per side black triangle. These black triangles, they're way too big. There's no way they could put this in a hangar. First of all, whoever said it was kept in a hangar? Whoever said that these were hidden in a hangar?
Right.
They could be underwater. It's unlimited at that point. And so, again, these could be unidentified submerged objects. They could be storing these things on the other side of Catalina Island. We'd never even know about it. So that's something to keep in mind. I believe the U.S. Navy is a lot more in control than people think.
Yeah, that's an interesting claim as well. I mean, what do you make of, what was it, someone like the hacker Gary McKinnon who allegedly stumbled over some ideas about, you know, Space Command and everything else? There was a couple of people who were deployed on you know, off-world projects, basically. Any truth to that, do you think?
Well, some of the names, the USSS Curtis LeMay. Isn't that interesting? Could that be United States spaceship? Who knows? I don't know. But I think there was a forestall in there as well. Personally, I just think that the U.S. Navy is definitely involved. They're definitely involved. And I don't think that the Air Force is at the top of the food chain. Certainly the National Security Agency, they know a lot. The CIA, they definitely know a lot. Starting with 1955 U-2 operations at Groom Lake, they know a lot. The NRO, the National Reconnaissance Office, knows a lot. But above and beyond that, I think the U.S. Navy is certainly involved.
Is there any other reason, do you think, why the Navy has either taken over or basically just running this at this stage and not sharing it with some of the other affiliations within the Army?
The only thing I would say to that, the reason why I think the U.S. Navy is involved is because of a statement by Greer and others as well, but Greer made an interesting comment years ago where he stated that there were cases where high-level Jesuit priests would show up at a dock where one of our nuclear-powered submarines was being docked there. And then he told the captain of the submarine, here's where we're going to go, and here's when we're going to go. And essentially, this Jesuit priest took over the command of that submarine, and they told them to go to a certain depth, and they were monitoring, tracking, and recording the movements of USOs going well over 250 knots underwater. All this was put on a data tape, and then they would go up to the surface. This guy would take this information, put it in a briefcase, go into a limousine, and then he disappeared. So, you know, that's why I feel that indeed the U.S. Navy is certainly involved. Coming from Stephen Greer, I tend to believe that that is a true statement.
So let me ask, what do you think it would take to kind of knock this field wide open and actually really get some answers beyond speculations and insiders speaking out and, you know, difficult to verify information and just really kind of get to the core and the truth of the matter of what really is going on out there, what really type of technology we have here? What would it take, do you think, to open this up?
Well, it's got to go back to Gordon Cooper's statement. It's going to take a coalition, a united coalition of well-known scientists within multiple disciplines who have physical evidence that can overrule the military and intelligence apparatus and come forth with the physical evidence. That's the only way we're ever going to make progress. The only way. Now, barring a sighting, a mass sighting where hundreds of thousands of people with their iPhones taking photographs, I mean, it's going to be hard to cover up something at that point. But again, I never underestimate what they can do on an unlimited black budget. There might be a case like that, but that doesn't mean it's extraterrestrial. They could be doing a false flag operation. We just don't know. The technology is seamless at this point. It's absolutely seamless. They've got quasi-crystal cloaking technology. They've got holographic image projection technology. So they could fake something if they really wanted to. So again, I never underestimate what they can do.
And at that stage, it almost seems to be a little bit more about us to a certain extent than what it is about them or what they're doing. Just as you said before, with the airliners and everything else, that they're just like, we've been... I mean, sure, we have, Twitter and Facebook today compared to like 10 years ago or whatnot. The computer industry has certainly gone forward. But when it comes to transportation and some of the other, major technological progresses that we would kind of hope to see in 2014, that hasn't really happened, right? We're kind of tied back. We're being held back,
Absolutely. I mean, we're living in a world that's decades, perhaps 100 or even many more years than that, behind where we should be. Tesla talked about it, how they're using zero point energy. We are decades behind where we need to be. We're living in a prison planet, no doubt about it. They're holding all of us hostage, and we're not going to be able to break into that world. That's just the way this is. So really, it's on every American taxpayer, everyone on the world, to fight their own personal crusade to see that visionary shining city on a hill that Reagan had talked about.
Do you put any hope in, we see kind of private space industries coming to the surface now? This could be something that potentially might actually help to expose something that goes on out there. Literally, they might stumble across something which is like, what the hell is this? In that sense, it's something that could even occur within, if people actually get together. I mentioned this to another couple of guests as well, but might sound silly, but, like an open source or crowd-funded space program, as opposed to, letting the government handle it, that has kind of run it into the ground and just taking all the money to the black budgets anyway, right? Because ingenuity, that's what we need. As material gets cheaper, more computing power gets available, resources and creativity, that might potentially even go a long way in these days. What do you think?
That's a good point. However, keep in mind that the space programs that are in service now, essentially we're talking about one and only, which is Burt Rutan, Spaceship Two. And he's done a fantastic job. He's done a great job. He's still using solid fuel rockets. And then to get the spaceship to the launch point, they're using conventional jet-powered turbofans. So essentially he's still using obsolete technologies that the Nazis used in World War II with their liquid rockets.
Right.
They use liquid rockets in the V-2. The Spaceship Two uses a solid fuel rocket. So even Bird is still using this technology. Now, it's going to be a huge leap to go to suborbital flights at $200,000 per paying passenger to what Ben Rich talked about, where they're traveling among the stars. That's a huge leap. They're not, you can bet your bottom dollar, they're not using liquid rockets in the black world.
Sure.
Liquid rockets have been obsolete for 60 years, without any doubt at all. Liquid rockets are completely obsolete. It's a done deal. So in point of fact, we have murdered 7 astronauts with the Challenger incident on January 20th, 1986. And the black world engineers who work in these programs that are keeping this technology from not only NASA, but the scientific community in general and the general public are held liable for the murder of those 7 astronauts without any doubt. And they're holding all of us hostage. So I don't think a private space program is going to get anywhere, because they don't have the toys. They don't have the technology to travel to the stars. They don't have the technology to be 50 years beyond what we can even comprehend from what Ben Rich stated. They're still using obsolete liquid and solid rocket propulsion. And we're never going to see anything until that other technology gets declassified.
All the steps along the way to get to the progression where they are, that's not something that's kind of in the, I guess, alternative realm as well.
No.
I mean, a lot of the things are being discussed, right?
I mean, it could take hundreds of years for the private industry to learn the secrets of tapping into the zero-point energy field. I mean, it could potentially take that long. It might be shorter, but you know that they're not going to be using liquid rockets to get to the stars. They're using a new form of propulsion system that has nothing to do with liquid rockets. Absolutely.
Unless they think outside of the box and actually dare to try something, which some of the crazy ingenuity people out there are talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, it can be done, but you're going to need engineers, you're going to need funding, you're going to need research development analysis. It's not going to be cheap. I mean, you know,
sure,
they spent billions figuring it out. You know they did. And then implying the technology into something useful took a lot of money.
Well, it's an extraordinary situation when you look at it that way, kind of zoom out and realize that there is a, with the aid of the people who's been funding it in that regard, it's been completely withheld. And the idea that they're, who knows what the heck they're up to, out there. And maybe they even have their own exploring missions at this stage and completely just, that's the idea, right? A breakaway civilization. You set something completely different up at this stage. And have you philosophized any deeper in terms of where the personnel to this kind of program is coming from? Is it all within the military, or is there more to it than that?
No, I don't think it's just the military. Again, I think it's a united coalition of a few small groups. I don't think it's just the military. Certainly the defense contractors, high-level military brass. We can go into other examples as well, but definitely it's, I just think it can't just be one group. Again, as I mentioned before, the U.S. Navy is involved. But, before we conclude tonight, there's a couple other quick cases that I wanted to highlight, because I think that they play a role in the secret space program, and they have a bearing on a couple of the other cases. I have a case here, February 17th, 1995, that was reported in the Burton Daily Mail. In the UK, they talked about a sighting that a gentleman had early in the morning when he was driving to work. He was in an SUV. He looked up and saw an elliptical-shaped craft that had a notch cut out of the back of it. It had two high-intensity bright white headlights in the front, and I'm going to show illustrations of this at the lecture. But then he said on the understructure of this vehicle, there were hundreds of what he called tubes, pipes, and cylinders sticking out of it, which is identical to the other three cases that we talked about. A few minutes later, this craft moved to the east at a medium rate of speed. That's what he said. It departed at a kind of a slow rate of speed. Then there was another case reported. This is from England, March 3rd, 1995, where, again, a gentleman was going to work in the morning, and this time he was on a motorcycle. The next thing he knew, his engine sputtered out, so he had to pull the motorcycle off to the side of the road, and then he found out that he was being bathed in a high-intensity, bright beam of light. So he looked up and saw the bottom of a square that had all these lights on it, but then he said it had tubes, pipes, and cylinders on the bottom of the square, and then this square moved off to the left, and what he was seeing was not, in point of fact, a square, but the base of a pyramid. So he was under a flying pyramid. He eventually had to walk his bike 3 miles back to his home. And then 2 weeks later, when researchers and investigators got to his location to interview him about this case, one of these researchers brought out a metallic Zippo lighter. And as soon as he pulled it out of his pocket, this lighter leapt out of his hands and went right to the gas tank of the motorcycle. His entire motorcycle had become magnetized. So now we've got five cases of the same motif of these tubes, pipes, and cylinders sticking out of either the bottom or left side of these crafts. So I don't think they're man-made whatsoever. I mean, I don't think they're extraterrestrial.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh boy! Well, that's very interesting. I think we can begin to wrap things up on that note for this time, Michael. It's been very nice having you here. Thank you for coming on, of course, and sharing some of your interesting material and some of these cases with us. And definitely, we'll pick this up in San Mateo here at the end of June this year. Looking forward to meeting you and every other of the speakers there as well. It's going to be very interesting. Again, the website for that then, secretspaceprogram.org, and please direct any questions and whatnot what you might have towards the organizers of that event. They have their contact email and everything else on the website as well. Give us the title of your book again, Michael, and where people can pick up a copy of that book.
Title of the book is called Retrievals of the Third Kind, a Reexamination of Leonard Stringfield's Crash Retrieval Cases. It's available as an ebook for $14.99 on MUFON's website.
Very good. We'll have that linked up as well. No direct websites and whatnot to give out today, but again, we refer you further to the MUFON website for the book. Thanks, Michael. We'll see you soon, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks a lot.
So don't forget that if you are a member and want to get tickets to the conference, go to redeyesmembers.com and click on the Secret Space Program banner, either from the radio archive or on the page for this program that you're listening to right now, and get your coupon code that knocks off a bit from the price there as well. We have upcoming Andrei Znamensky on the dark side of Tibetan Buddhism, Mark McClandish, Petter Amundsen, Ashari S, aka DM Murdoch, and many more exciting guests. In the meantime, we say thank you so much for being a member and for listening, for your interest. Have a great rest of your day, wherever you're at, and we'll speak to you more soon. Bye-bye.